Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
He is my request. Well, come back to me. He is my request. Well, come back to me. He is my request.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs are Arkansas's prime purveyors of true blue honky-tonk music. Brad Williams writes the songs and fronts the band and has one of the finest traditional country voices in the Mid-South. They've received accolades from all quarters, and their records have received rave reviews in the U.S., the U.K., and continental Europe. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here strumming his 1931 national resonator is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured guitarist for the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi, and he can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton, with his portraits of Robert Johnson, Elvis Presley, and Junior Kimbrough, all of which are for sale. Our listeners can find out more about these paintings and Doug at our website, which is talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week, our writers are all on the road traveling, some on business, some on vacation, and all end up different than when they started. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Tyler Thompson is backpacking in Europe when a rendezvous is planned. And we'll end the night with John Wells, who travels to familiar slopes, and then things get slippery. But let's start the night with Alan Eastham on the other side of the world, and that's just the beginning in A Day in France.
Part one, Panneau Touristique, the historic marker. My assistant said they want you to inaugurate a panneau touristique. Now, unveiling a tourist sign didn't sound very interesting, nor did it seem essential to the interests of the United States of America and southern France. But I was near the end of my time in Bordeaux, and I was feeling that I hadn't seen enough of the far mountainous south. She handed me the letter from the local authorities in Saint-Girons, south of Toulouse, in the foothills of the French Pyrenees. The letter was sparse, mentioning only that the sign would commemorate the WiiWii network, which operated during World War II in the region. It was evident that details would be forthcoming at the event, and there was enough mystery in it to entice me to go, especially since I'd already scheduled a less pleasant meeting about an airplane crash at an aircraft manufacturer in Toulouse. I drove myself down in the official car. Arriving at Saint-Girons, I met up with a group of local notables at the mayor's office. We drove out to the crossroads where a veiled sign awaited us. It was raining as we pulled the veil off what amounted to a historical marker. I read about the intelligence network whose members carried reports and messages across the Pyrenees during the war. The sign highlighted the work of a heroic Frenchman named Roger Rieux, a shepherd whose hollowed-out walking stick hid the messages about the defenses of Marseille and other important war information. After the mayor's speech, the business seemed to be done. A man approached me. He said, Roger Rioux is my father. At this point, we were coming up on the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, so I figured the best tack was to thank him for his father's service. He acknowledged it, and then he said, the United States sent him a medal, but nobody ever came to present it to him. I said, I was sorry about that. He said, could you do it? Turning toward a small man in a military-style sweater with leather epaulette and elbow patches, I realized this was the guy. Suddenly, I was transported into one of those old spy movies set in Europe during the war, where it's always raining and the characters are ordinary folks whose lives were transformed by calamitous events and great deeds. This man, who had kept sheep for a living, had walked across the Pyrenees every week or two at peril of death. His son handed me a small leather case, and in it was a tarnished medal. This was one of those moments that test your savoir-faire. I had to get this right, especially since this man was standing right in front of me. Ordinarily, this would be a ceremony of some weight and gravity, but it had arrived without any notice at all. It would be much better to have more than 5 seconds to think about how you were going to do this. As I recall, he saluted me, I saluted back, I took the medal out of its worn little case, pinned it on his sweater, saluted again, exchanged the Gallic kisses, and noticed the tears in his eyes and mine. Part two, Les Ours d'Ersay, the Bears of Ersay. Did you say bears? I asked the mayor of Ersay. We were at the bar in a bistro in Saint-Jérôme, having celebrated the inauguration of a tourist sign nearby. We'd had a nice lunch, some decent wine, and were presently finishing up with a little cognac. I had asked him, as I always did, what the village of Ersay was famous for. He had rather unexpectedly said, bears. Yes, he said, we're known for our bears, though there aren't any more around. This seems strange to me. No bears, but Ersay is famous for them. The mayor then said, how about you come to Ersay and see our new bear museum? We negotiated for a bit, and perhaps encouraged by the wine and the cognac, we jumped in his SUV and headed down a gravel road. I had not at this point seen any gravel roads in France, especially any leading to a town. But this was obviously a familiar road to the mayor, since he drove it as though he was on one of France's no speed limit autoroutes. About 10 miles out, we came to a little cluster of buildings in a pretty valley. He parked in the barely two-lane street, jumped out, and unlocked the municipal building. Upstairs, to my amazement, was a cute modern museum devoted to the famous bears of Ersay. But what made them famous was not the bears so much as the whole concept. To wit, in the late 19th century, Pyrenees bears were world travelers. The men who accompanied the bears were the real stars of the show, the Montreurs d'Ours, or bear show men, and they all came from Ersay, leading their bears, especially to America, to travel our byways with dancing bears. There was even a training academy for a time in Ersay to teach the exhibitors how to handle and care for the bears. In the museum, there were muzzles and leashes, photographs, and some poignant letters from places like Chicago. Like this. You would not believe what the dogs do when I approach a town with my bear. It is very difficult. This business is no good. I'm not making any money. And my personal favorite, my bear died. Please send another. The pride with which the mayor showed this small piece of France was evident. It was clear that this was about all his village had to offer to draw tourists and visitors, and he claimed credit for obtaining the French government grant that financed its creation. For my part, a charming and completely unexpected gift. On the way back to Saint-Jérôme, the mayor mentioned that Balkan brown bears were being relocated into the region. There was a gleam in his eye as he contemplated the notion that someday Hersey would again have actual bears, since, of course, that was what the village was famous for. Driving back across France that soft summer evening with the window down and French talk radio documenting some point of French history, I couldn't help thinking about spies, medals, and bears and smiling the whole way back at what a wonderfully strange day it had been.
Easton teaches foreign policy at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas. During his previous career with the U.S. Department of State, he spent a year in France as U.S. Consul General in Bordeaux. In our next story, Tyler Thompson agrees to what could be a very risky caper in a bygone communist era in Eyes Opened.
As I worked my way down to the final stern face at Checkpoint Charlie that would give me the nod to pass into East Berlin, I wondered if I had made a huge mistake. It was August of 1972, and my satchel hung heavily on my shoulder, concealing the packet I had agreed to pass along to a female contact. The Cold War was still as cold as ever, and I could feel its chill shivering through me even as I watched those East German guards looking over my passport and visa in the heat of summer. No one cracked a joke, much less a smile. They wore the required drab uniforms of the East German Army, packing holstered pistols and shouldered rifles. I stepped up to the last guard, got the nod, and walked through the wall to the east. As I slowly walked along the cobbled street, I soon settled on a well-worn concrete bench. I laid my satchel by my side and double-checked that I still had the packet inside. It was there, and I double-checked just to make sure it was still there. It was. 9:30 a.m. now, and I had until 4 o'clock to complete my task. At that moment, I thought that the smartest thing I could do was turn around and go back west, young man. Why did I feel like that I was in the middle of a movie I had never seen before? In the spring of 1972, I was finishing my first year teaching in Pine Bluff and making plans to spend the summer in Europe. A teacher didn't bring home burgeoning paychecks, but with purchasing a cheap round-trip flight from New York to Luxembourg, staying in youth hostels and riding the rails with a Eurail pass, I managed to budget on the money I had saved. I'd have to hitchhike from Arkansas to New York and back, but that's another tale. Heading out on this adventure by myself, I joined up with other young folks riding the trains from all over Europe, Canada, Japan, and yes, the United States. In the evenings, we would check into a hostel and before bed would share ideas about our next day's plans. If some wanted to take in sights together, it made for terrific companionship. You went where you wanted to go, and others either joined up with you or didn't. It was a great way to see Europe. On the German leg of the trip from Copenhagen, we had to travel over the East German tracks to get to West Berlin. Arriving in mid-morning at the Bahnhof, we found the city vibrant with people, hustling and bustling, and cars, trucks, and trolley trams crowding the streets with an obvious optimism and purpose. Six of us banded together and saw the sights, especially wanting to view the Brandenburg Gate. After checking into a hostel later, we discussed what we wanted to do the next day. The other five chose to head out to a city park for swimming and horseback riding. But I had read about tourists being allowed to make day trips into East Berlin, and that was my goal. The others told me I was nuts. The Hausfrau who ran the hostel overheard us and asked me, if I were going into the Eastern sector, would I mind doing her a favor? She said that the hostel's cook had escaped from the East a few years earlier through one of the tunnels that had been bored beneath the wall, but that the rest of her family hadn't made it out. The Hausfrau said that she had been fortunate enough herself because her family had all fled before the wall had been completed. As a result, none of them could return to visit other family and friends. Of course, folks from the East couldn't travel to the West. She said that the cook, Greta, would be very happy if I would take a small packet to her sister the next day. She worked at a cafe not far beyond Checkpoint Charlie, the gate I would have to pass through to get to East Berlin. The Hausfrau was quite convincing, and I found myself not able to come up with a good reason to say no. Naive that I was, I must have forgotten the one about, "Are you crazy? Risk my life delivering some unknown packet to someone I don't even know in a city I've never been in a country run by communists?" Nope, I didn't think of that one. The next morning, the Hausfrau and Greta walked me to Checkpoint Charlie, where I entered the Allied command post and crossed from the safety of the West to the uncertainty of the East. There I was, through the Berlin Wall, carrying paraphernalia unknown to me, sealed in a packet intended for someone I knew not, in a location I had never been, in a part of the world that I had only read about in mysteries and seen in spy movies. Running through my mind was a word I had learned from Hogan's Heroes. Doomkopf! I had been told that the cafe where Greta's sister worked was four streets down and about 100 meters to the left. I was amazed at the rundown nature of the streets and buildings and the paltry number and quality of motor vehicles. Whereas West Berlin reflected optimism and a flourishing prosperity, its counterpart was gray and depressing. On a day trip, one was required to exchange the equivalent of about $20 into East German marks. I did wander in a few stores that I had found open, but the pickings were very sparse. I did find Greta's sister's cafe, but I couldn't muster the courage to enter on my first pass of it. I did wander through a sad bookstore run by a man and woman in serious need of dental care and deodorant, and found a secondhand clothing store which enticed me not one iota. I wandered around East Berlin for the next few hours looking at some buildings mentioned in my guidebook and did some people watching, you know, nodding at folks and smiling when they looked at me. But the few who returned my smile did so with their lips, but not with their eyes. By 2 o'clock, I was pretty hungry and forced myself to again approach that cafe. It was small with zero ambiance, and only two well-worn middle-aged people worked there, a man behind a primitive counter and a pudgy diminutive woman ready to serve the empty tables. As previously instructed at the hostel, after sitting at a table, I slowly opened my satchel and removed a paperback book with an orange cover and a small packet tucked among its pages. I laid it on the table to my right, and soon the short, hefty woman I took to be Greta's sister approached, pointing to the menu chalked on the board behind the counter. I clumsily motioned my selection, and she went to the back. After a while, she returned with a bowl of nondescript soup and hard bread set before me, along with a spoon and a beer. Almost in the same motion, she knocked the book off the table onto the floor and quickly and apologetically made motions to dust off the book and return it to its place on the table. Overdoing her fussing, she backed out of the room. I was so hungry I could have eaten a copy of the East German newspaper. And eating that soup and bread gave me a pretty good idea about how that periodical might have tasted. Finishing the beer, I noticed that the book still held the packet between its pages, except that the packet was of a darker tinge and was of a slightly different size than I recalled. The woman had made a switch during the drama with the book, and I realized that there was a second part of this escapade yet to come I had not anticipated. I left the cafe hoping to nonchalantly roam the potholed streets of the city, when actually the thing I wanted to do was head back in the straightest of lines to Checkpoint Charlie, ending this day's caper. Bond, James Bond, I was not. By 3:30, I finally returned to the checkpoint, acting like it was only the summer heat that was causing my discomfort and the dampness soaking my clothing. Though it only took about a quarter hour to get through the passport and visa checks, it appeared to transpire in extremely slow motion. Surprising me, though it shouldn't have, sitting on a wooden bench across from the exit of the building and guardrail was Greta, in her loose-fitting, multicolored duster, clutching her purse. She arose and quickly closed the distance between us, pulling me into a bear hug. She then went into a rushed soliloquy, of which I understood not a single German word, but inferred that she was expecting something from me. So I opened my satchel and handed her the orange-covered book with the packet between the pages. She pulled out the packet with tears in her eyes as we sat down and she slowly opened her new delivery. It included a long letter with what appeared to be news about family and friends from a world she had left, causing cascades of tears. When she got to the end of the letter, she would start all over again at the beginning, reading aloud in German. Also included in the packet were a few photos and some pieces of cloth which were completely lost upon me. She was both happy and sad, laughing and crying, ecstatic and blue, expressive and introspective. I sat on that bench with Greta for over an hour. I hadn't understood a word that she had read, but I didn't need to. My eyes had been opened to one of the realities of Cold War Europe. And then she stood up, carefully placed the letter, photos, and cloth back in her purse, and gestured for me to stand. She hugged me once more, took my arm, and then we began walking, making our way back to the hostel.
Just so you know, Dr. Tyler Thompson, who currently resides in Little Rock, survived his Iron Curtain experience, as evidenced by his being here tonight. What you don't see are the scars he incurred between then and now. In our final story of the night, we come back to the States with John Wells on a ski slope, and the snowballing begins in Slippery Slopes.
One beautiful sunny afternoon, while skiing the picturesque slopes of Brighton, Utah, I encountered an inopportune combination of velocity, terrain, and gravity that proved to be quite problematic. I took one wrong turn and the smooth trail I expected to see instead revealed itself to be a mogul field, textured with huge foreboding mounds of doom, which it turns out grossly exceeded my ability to negotiate. I fell hard on my right shoulder, no tuck, no roll. I went straight from lightning fast to dead stop in an instant. You know, when I was a youngster, I didn't know how to snow ski, not because I didn't want to, but because I lived in Arkansas. I was a full-grown adult before I skied the first time, which occurred in the year of our Lord, 1977. The same year, I moved to Salt Lake City. At that time of my life, I was ready for just about anything this new environment had to offer. I was a young hormonal male, and I was just now old enough to drink. Turns out Salt Lake City wasn't particularly conducive to either one. However, they did lay claim to having the greatest snow on earth. I'll always remember my first run. One of the locals there took me skiing. Thank God he knew how to teach. He showed me all I needed to know in order to shoosh the slopes of Utah. He spent seconds, if not minutes, with me before departing to enjoy his day of skiing. I was left alone on my very first run. At the end of the day, I was battered, drenched, and exhausted, and quickly decided that snow skiing was not for me. That was until my ex-girlfriend from Little Rock decided to take a ski vacation to Denver to meet a potential new boyfriend. Motivated by hormones, loneliness, and jealousy, I decided she should extend her vacation to come see me. "Do you know how to ski?" she asked. Sure. Utah's got the greatest snow on earth. Sans any logical reasoning, I promised to take her skiing. Turns out I'd learned a little more than I thought that first day. My girlfriend also showed me a few things her instructor taught her. Combine that with alcohol, persistence, and a little luck, we were soon lumbering down the slopes having a wonderful time. I was hooked. Until I moved back to Arkansas some 2 years later, I went snow skiing every chance I could. Not only was I hooked on skiing, but also on the Brighton ski area we discovered that day. Even after I moved back to Arkansas, I vacationed there year after year, girlfriend after girlfriend. Brighton is still my favorite. So 30 years later, I returned to Brighton, this time with my wife and another couple. I was now a veteran skier with hundreds of Brighton runs under my belt. They changed over time, but I still knew the place like the back of my hand. Or so I thought. I was wrong. I didn't remember anything about those huge foreboding mounds of doom. "You all right?" my friend asked. My shoulder took quite a hit. I'm not sure. I was able to get up and ski to the bottom, but I knew something wasn't right. Brighton has a nice first aid station. I knew exactly where it was. Drawing on my vast knowledge of the resort, I opted for an even better place, the bar. There one finds everything one needs for such an emergency. A warm environ to prevent shock. Ice to prevent swelling. And beer for responsible pain management. Even more convenient, my ski partner just happened to be a medical professional. Soon I was convalescing comfortably with a trained clinician by my side. A bag of ice wedged in my suit, and a prescription-strength beer on the way. My recovery was going well. The first order of business, learn to drink beer left-handed. With my talent, I adapted quickly. Back in the car, my friend recommended we get a sling. We obtained one along the way, and my entourage assured that my skiing was done, entertained fantasies of me occupying the lodge for the duration. They were unanimously out of touch with my vision. I didn't travel 1,000 miles to wuss out at the first sign of trouble. I saw myself skiing all 3 of the remaining days up to the last possible moment before heading back to Little Rock. The first day went well. I took it easy, skiing well below my potential, and I did fine. Although there was one moment when I thought I was going to fall and instinctively reached out my right arm. That hurt. The second day of skiing went very well, but not so much afterwards. Back at the Deer Valley Ski Resort changing area, I struggled to remove the tight-fitting boots when suddenly I slipped. Just as I had the day before, I instinctively braced with my right arm, which this time resulted in a fully dislocated right shoulder, followed by an immediate sensation of significant discomfort. Now, a better man might have taken a moment to fully consider the family atmosphere of the changing room. He might have paused to ponder the dignity of the predominantly Mormon populace therein. A culture well known for restraint, sacrifice, and a vengeance for avoiding vices, temptation, and illicit language. A better man might have thought in an instant to exclaim, "Ouch," or "Gee willikers," or "Golly, that hurts." Not me. I'm Methodist. There in that changing area in excruciating pain, I hurl several clearly enunciated wordy dirds in abundant quality and at way more than sufficient volume to be heard by all. I use combinations of words that this audience had apparently never previously enjoyed. My impromptu soliloquy covered such topics as to include, but not limited to, bodily functions, genetic lineage, inappropriate family relations, and of course, questionable use of our Lord's name. Within seconds, my friend rushed to my aid and popped my shoulder back in place, resulting in an immediate and welcome end to my pain. Now calm and centered, I turned to face my audience. I looked into their widely opened eyes and reflected back on my oration. In the faces of parents, I saw concern. They were surely pondering the long ride home and the questions their children were now bound to ask. "No, honey," he said, "he's got dandruff and some of it itches." That profanity-laden moment ended any argument that I was stable enough to ski the third day. I would instead enjoy myself mingling with the members of Salt Lake's healthcare community. Initial x-rays revealed that I had an avulsion fracture of the right shoulder. The bad news, no more skiing this year. The good news, great pain meds. Waiting at the pharmacy, I spotted a nice pullover. On the front it said, "Ski hard. Chicks dig scars." I still own it. Funny, I never realized what a conversation starter a sling is. At first, I enjoyed telling the story over and over. There I was, minding my own business, skiing 20 miles an hour faster than my age. Then I returned to work, and it continued. And it wasn't like everyone attended a meeting where I could tell the story once. No, I'd finish telling the story, and another one would round the corner and ask, "What's with the sling?" I told friends, I told relatives, I told doctors, and ultimately I told my physical therapist. Then his assistant walked up and prompted me yet again. The thought of telling this story one more time was now more than I could handle. Something snapped. The boundaries of the truth had become perimeters I could no longer dwell within. I replied. It all started when my wife took up boxing. I was totally ad-libbing, thinking surely she knew I was kidding, to my amazement, as well as her bosses standing right behind her. She was buying it hook, line, and sinker. So I continued. The bigger her eyes got, the more I embellished. You know, it was kind of cute at first. You know, she'd hit me and I'd say, ooh, that hurt and stuff. And then when they taught her to straighten her wrist, well, then I knew I had to be a little more careful. Then they started with her on her footwork. That's when the trouble started. One day, she fakes a left hook and I go for it. In a split second, I knew I was toast. She came ground up with a straight right to the body and dropped me like a rock. Really? Yeah, and then she's like, get up, you big baby, and fight like a man. Wow. Then my wife returned. One look at her and this lady bolted. The missus looked at me quite puzzled. What's with her? I have no idea.
John Wells, a native of Little Rock, is a beer and food critic, as well as an avid craft beer enthusiast. He writes for johnthebeersnob.com and blogs via Facebook under the name John the Beer Snob. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.